Hello, we'd like to welcome you to this panel. This is But Dawn in the New Horizon, Sunstone Poets Read Their Poetry. And all of the panelists here have been published or will be published in Sunstone, as we'll have some of their poetry published there. And I'd just like to introduce everyone on the panel. On my far left is Cara Bollinger O'Sullivan. And she has published quite a number of poems in Sunstone and has been published in other places, BYU Studies, and other publications at BYU and Scape and The Leading Edge, and has been writing for a number of years. She's had a distinguished career as an editor and has been the editor of Utah Business Magazine, was there for quite some time, and is working as director of public relations at iOmega, and writes beautiful poetry all the time. Virginia Ellen Baker, has also had a distinguished career in editing. She was the features editor at the Land Times, among many other things that you've done over the years. And I should mention before I forget, both of these women have done or did theses at BYU that were collections of their own poetry. And I was glad to see that both of them brought them today. There's some beautiful poems from there, and I'd like to have them read some of those. Ginny has also published quite a few poems in Sunstone. She's been published in BYU Studies and a number of other places. She won an international writing contest, won first place in this contest, the Writers of the Future contest, 2 years ago, I guess, for a short story, 4 years ago, for a short story, and has since been published in Asimov Science Fiction Magazine, or had a story accepted there, Tomorrow's Speculative Fiction. I can't think of any of the other places, but anyway, has a lot of fiction coming out, and also her poetry. And interestingly enough, just had a poem accepted yesterday to probably be the lead piece in a new science fiction anthology of virtual reality stories. And we'll get to that later, probably, when we actually get to the poem. Then on my right is David Knowlton. And David is a professor of anthropology at BYU. And he has a focus in social anthropology from Latin America, he was telling me. And interestingly enough, I just read his poetry yesterday and accepted some of it, or the day before yesterday, I guess. I called him and said, would you come and read your poetry here? And it was really interesting reading his poems because many of them were in Spanish. And it would be interesting if you read some of those. I thought that was great that you could write poetry in two languages. You know, the poems I accepted were in English, but he also did poetry in Spanish. And I thought that was pretty impressive. And these, he tells me, will be his first poems published, which is wonderful. I think
the secret life comes out.
I think you'll love them when you see them too. I think these are going to be the first of many poems published. I hope so. So, and I am Shane Bell. I'm the poetry editor of Sunstone, and I am also a science fiction writer. I've had a novel published last year from Bain Books, and I've had stories published in Asimov Science Fiction Magazine and Tomorrow Speculative Fiction, and all the places Ginny has too, I guess, and fantasy and science fiction and different places like that. And then I've also published science fiction poetry. And in fact, most of the poetry that I have published has been in the science fiction magazines, though I've had some published in Dialogue and Sunstone also. And so I will actually read you some science fiction poetry. This will probably be a new thing for most of you. And I'll start, in fact, with one. What I'd like us to do is I'll just read a poem, and then maybe we'll go to my left, and let Ginny and Carr read, and come back to David, and we'll just go down the road, each of us reading one of our poems. And then eventually I'm going to start reading some poems that I've accepted that haven't been published yet in Sunstone and give you kind of a preview of what's coming up. There's some beautiful things yet to come. And so that will be kind of fun. I'll start though with this poem called The Time Traveler Comes to Cana. So I went to Cana and spent Sabbath in that house, their guest, before the wedding. The daughter spoke with joy of her marriage. The mother sat impatient. Sabbath's end, the time for her to cook what food they had. The father counted too few flasks of wine again and again, too few for his guests. I would have given money. I had it. Roman drachmas hidden in bags of wrapped cups they thought I traded in Galilee. Take these cups, I told them. Serve the wine you have in them. And they marveled at the cup's craftsmanship, and I never explained they were mass-produced in Mexico. Not one cup survived to become a new relic. I traced all 12 cups to the dumping grounds outside Cana, all broken in 3 years, fragments thrown out as if they meant nothing. So the wedding day came slowly for us, and he came, and his mother. She and he sat at a table like all the others. I thought, he did miracles. I'd proved that when I'd wandered through Judea 2 years after his undoubted crucifixion. hearing secondhand accounts of his work. So many thousands had seen him, had heard his words. Some few had seen him heal lepers or the lame. I talked to a once blind girl who wept to tell me how he spit on dirt to make mud with which he anointed her eyes. She wiped it off and saw his face first. I could never find the lepers. Not one, once cured, ever admitted to that cure, ever said, but for him, I'd be unclean. So we ate and drank that day at the wedding, and I thought, he did miracles. I thought, I have come so far to see one. I thought, will he know? Will he know how far I've come, or how quickly after I got permission, or how many years I tried for permission? And I thought, would he do it with me here, or would he wait till some other wedding in Cana? I knew the sequence of events, if I could trust the one evangelist. But when the wine ran out, I, impatient, called for more, as if I were drunk, as if there were more wine. And when the father brought what he thought would be water and poured it apologetically in empty cups, I heard the growing murmurs of surprise. I held my cup a long time, watching him, before I tasted what was in my cup. We'll see if Asimov covers that or something.
I want to tell you before starting, I'm not drunk, although I wish at this moment that I was. Sorry, we've done that before. When I saw the movie Hamlet, I've read the play several times, but I think the movie brought home a few things for me that, especially Ophelia, the plight of Ophelia, and how just reading the play, you don't really notice her. She's more of a sideline, and yet in the movie, she's a little more of a tragic figure. And so I wrote the poem Ophelia While Dying. I'll read that to you. Her humble feet bare to dirt and grass, bled roses everywhere she went. At a shallow pool past Elsinore, the maid sang while the sun planted fullness on the vines in her hair, and begged to remember its fire on the fine russet threads of the millinery. It had woven her afternoons of the color of his eyes watching her, beneath the pale blue of burnished ore and the deeper indigo of his smile. This light in spring eclipsed her name, its shadows dappled on her eyes, clouds scudding over a plain choked with poppies. At the water's edge, she held buttercups up beneath her chin. In the low croak of lilies, she saw her own ghost, her death in visions composed of the Godhead, the Father, his Son, and her lover, laughing sweet the tang of bitter ale, warmed by a fire spiced with clover and winter wheat. A tear may have rippled it, for the splash she made as she reached out, say, to catch them in her hands, and found none. She searched the pool all that day, talking to that woman, that other in the water, with the twigs in her hair. Each step cast her image further out. The sun descended, flared across the surface of the water, and made a crown of small dying suns, glinting motes in its halo like flies. Her eyes caught new visions in that light, and the honeysuckle bloomed to pull her down, heavy in her leaves. She sank slow enough to watch the path of her falling cleave the world and swirl it clean above her. The hovering images mulched a balm on her open eyes. The clouds on them beat a moment's pulse while the swaying roots of willows held her head. A swan curved its crown neck past her shadow. Its wings were bright with the sun's going down, impossibly white. The copper of its feet churned the water. This hushed wake alone marked her passing.
I just have to say I really appreciate the opportunity to read it. And it always warms my heart when in the 1990s people still gather to listen to poetry being read. So I think you should all compliment yourselves very much for that.
I was just going to say before you start, Cara, if you want to move forward, if you're having trouble hearing, please feel free to. We don't have a microphone. This is just for recording purposes, evidently, so we can't pass this back. I guess we could. They're few enough. If you want, we certainly don't mind having you sit up here close. So that's fine. You'll be able to hear them.
My poem is entitled "Meeting," Part One. Isaac. I came from the well. Excuse me. I came from the way of the well, Bir Lahoiroi, the well of him who lives and sees me, to meet the woman my father's servant found for me. I walked into the field at evening to watch the sun withdraw from the farthest hills. The stars entered their kingdom as the veil of day was drawn slowly away. My father and his stars, the endless grains of sand on every shore. For the last glint of sun, I raised my eyes. saw shadows against its brilliance. Camels coming. I rose and felt the earth below me and the plants growing in the furrows I passed through. I saw her before she took a veil and covered hair that fell in ropes of ebony, eyes brown as the rich soil of fields that lie beside the Nile. This is what Father Adam knew when he took Eve from the hand of the Lord, my wife, my sister, my spouse. We entered the Garden of Eden again. To Rebecca. The evening wind stirred the grain, bringing the laughter of strangers from tents. I stared at the gold bracelets on my wrist, feeling the weight of their claim. I longed to run behind my father's tents, laughing, my arms bare. The servant of my unknown husband shouted, raised his arm. I lifted my eyes and saw a man striding through the field. His eyes were dark, dark as the eyes of a roe, the eyes of one who lives and sees the Lord. Already knowing, I asked the servant who this man was. I covered myself with a veil. His hands removed it.
Well, I'm going to begin with the risk of reading one that Shane hasn't seen. This was written when I was getting very frustrated with the very limited strictures of formal scientific writing. There's so much that you can't express. And I was feeling very frustrated, particularly with some comments on one of my writings that I was being too metaphoric. Anyway, I write what I feel. Deceptions, loves, laughter, heresy. From deep inside, these well up, while seagulls glide on their afternoon breeze. When shrunk by the wash of a friend's betrayal, recoiling inward with agony, surrounded by bilious clouds of despair, a ray of sun suddenly speaks to me. Still in my writhing and lightening my mood, it gently and warmly pushes and pulls my soul from its small state to stretch as if to fill the sky. While singing and dancing in the streets, impulsed by love's euphoria, I cannot sense, nor can I feel the stony glares of conventional formality. I feel inside like a silly rainbow, skipping from the waves of an ice blue lake over terraced hills and stippled clouds to arch itself from dawn to dusk. The life becomes serious from sudden loss. I cannot resist a baby's eyes. They search past your spot, past your mind, until they find the smile and the chuckle hidden inside. Mere words, that's all these are. Why do they act as dividing lines? As if like cliffs they could separate the gentle shade of a cottonwood from the harsh, craggy canyon of the sky. Can words deny our coming from a single womb, or that the same wind musses all our hair? Should words create a separate state for those who speak with other tongues, as if all sounds did not descend from the trilling, spiraling voice of the air as it tickles the world in which we live? We live by rules, others made in a society of friends, families, churches, classes, and clans. But none of these can ever beat the silent scintillation of a fleck of mica on a path. We need the rules and social groups, so long as they recognize the tiny light that stirs us to creativity. To live, we must work each in a different way, by bending nature to create what others want in an interchange of life, hope, and dependency. That makes in this complexity the delicate millennial balance of a mountain meadow seem simple felicity. But man and meadow are all the same. They cannot live without the summer showers. From that same source they take sustenance. If that is not enough for all to see, both field grass and humankind require for fecundity the simple hurting truth of death. With our words we hide ourselves from others. From fear of straightforward truths we subdivide and categorize our feelings, forgetting that life really holds the clarity of a morning dove cooing in a gentle sun. Our thoughts seem clear, precise, well-formed, yet fail from unseen ambiguity. They can never completely describe blue eyes shining with emotion or the maternal care of a cow moose for her shining calf in a mountain pasture. Science is reduction, reification, and abstraction. It picks and chooses and often loses what life requires. The economy will never work without what models contain beauty, elegance, and a touch of wit. Unless I write the way I feel, sometimes in ponderous, pretentious prose for academics to peruse, Other times, a flower's stare returns me to a gentler mood, where metaphor reigns supreme, and seagulls nicely express my theme. No matter what I choose to write, these words never can compare. I think I've lost the last few lines. But basically, these words never can compare with gentle rain upon our face.
You're already doing long poetry.
I started with long poetry.
You do.
Yes.
I'd like to read one called Romeo to Juliet in Utah. This poem was published in Asimov Science Fiction magazine. They brought us here to Utah, Juliet, and I will see, and I will love you again. I will see you in your father's house, and it will not matter that actors speak our family's names, our own names, wrong. You will still be more lovely than jewels in an Ethiop's ear. More lovely, Juliet, than that metaphor this audience may not understand. What hush? The chorus on stage? We must follow, but Juliet, see the crowd sitting in seats, there, waiting. What do men and women feel when they see us with our knives and potions, when they watch you kiss me, hoping not for love, but for poison?
This one's entitled Ekaterina Eterna. In death I loved you more. Ekaterina, did the grave give you freedom? Do you sway the graces with your dance, like you did mine? Did you like this dance? Eyes wet and round, the green of water lilies. Each step a cringe against imagined wrath, against all that is unfair and held in the world. How you love to dance. I held you before your mouth heated horror and grew it there in your heart. It was not enough. What you needed could fill the skies, the unfairness of it. I watched as you went down. You hated me for seeing, but held on to me still. Who else would know your song, the beauty of it, gone but still remembered? I would. I do. If death is ever kind, it will be kind for you. The stillness in your limbs came before. You knew. And the quiet around me still dances with you. I am left behind in the procession, knowing that duty is heavy, but hard to put down.
The oldest dreams. Too many voices are calling from the land, coming across the sand like noise drones over the tide that croons the song given by the mother and the father. I have forgotten to listen to the words that speak of depths where our oldest dreams are born, never to die, but rise with the tide and land upon the beaches where we sleep, listening to what the mother desires to teach. But the world's din pulls us from her arms. Her words recede with the tide to mere whispers we tuck in her pockets or toss aside. Let us walk the shore in silence, listening to the seagull crying like a soul that has lost the name of God. We will pause when a sea star lies across our path, its arms open to us as though it would speak of all the dreams we cannot name but shall always seek.
Waiting in a restless breeze, a squirrel spar marking across the park your springtime space. Waiting in melancholy sunlight as mallards fly by searching for rushes in which to nest. Waiting.
That poem. Obviously, because I took that. You'll see that picture sometime. It's beautiful. I've been reading Omar Khayyam. I've been reading a lot of poetry out of Iran and the Near East. And I was doing that at the time that Isaac Asimov died earlier this year. And I wrote this poem called Drink Then and Lie With Me After Khayyam. I mean, it's after Khayyam. That's not part of the title. But drink then and lie with me to watch the stars. When morning blots them out, find time to sleep. If one star falls, remember, with dawn, all stars will fade, and we go day by day dreaming of the night. So watch the stars, and mourn them when they fall, and drink until the morning blots them out. What other night will shine like this? Drink now, and lie with me.
This one is the frontispiece to the book that Shane mentioned.
We've got to tell that story too.
Go ahead.
Kara and Ginny are two poets that I've been able to rely on for years. We've worked together for quite some time. And when I need a poem for a certain kind of issue for a magazine I've been working on or something, I've been able to call them both and say, I need a poem this afternoon or tomorrow. Can you get me one? And they're somehow able to concentrate and come up with absolutely beautiful poems that then go on to, you know, be considered the best out of the issue and all that sort of thing. Well, yesterday I was talking to an editor of an anthology. I have a story coming out in this virtual reality anthology I was talking about. And I told her that I have had a book accepted at Signature Books, which is called Washed by a Wave of Wind, which is going to be an anthology of science fiction stories set in Utah. And this editor of mine said, that is such a beautiful title. She said, where did you get that? And I said, well, it's a quote from a poem of a friend of mine. It's a quote from a poem Ginny did that was published in Sunstone called Sinai, which I hope you brought a copy and you can read that later. Yeah. And in fact, another line of that poem is the title of this panel, or another line from that poem is the title of this panel. But anyway, she said, oh, I wish I had a poem of hers. I'd take a line from that and use it as the title for my book. And I said, well, Ginny just might be able to do something for you. And I told her about our experiences over the years. So Carrie Jacobson, who's the editor of the Southern Anthology, called Ginny and asked her if she could write her a poem. And Ginny said, call me up. I said, I'm going to kill you. You know, how can I do this? 20 minutes later, called me back with this beautiful poem. And this is it.
He used to sign me up for Thai lessons over the phone at BYU. It's called I Touch a Breath of Dreams. And, of course, the environment in which it is written is for a virtual reality environment. I went to Dachau to stop the Nazis, then on to Golgotha Morning Christ, where I rolled the stone aside myself. On Stratford, the bard launched the tempest to the sound of marching boots, while the symphonies of Mahler wrung the tears I had thought forever gone, water that the dying children of Niger had stolen from their swollen lips. Nietzsche and Freud argued while Einstein laughed and ciphered infinities on a dusty chalkboard outside of Rome. The Vatican called our Albert in to demand an answer, why he thought the world was round. He blessed the Pope with a kiss. I went among them all the while, a corporeal angel at verity's edge, dizzy with worlds and pale in my cerements. In every one I touch a breath of dreams and spread a banquet for my friends, another 10 who have died on the evening news. The food here remains mine to give. This time, I think, fish and wine to the millions starving in Marrakesh.
It'll be interesting to see which line she takes now.
Yeah. It'll be fun.
Yes.
The poem I'm going to read was published in Sunstone, and it kind of addresses what has been for a lot of us who remain single longer than the cultural norm in the church dictates often have to deal with. This is called For Those Looking Too Hard for Love. You wonder, when the tree boughs hang heavy with apples that swell with days of sun and rain, why the fruit has not yet fallen into your hands. You have forsaken climbing, for the boughs of love are too fragile, too tenuous for the studied search. Standing in the orchard's shadow has cost you time, as you wait like a wine goblet filled to overflowing that sits untouched upon the table. Arise now. You have stood by the fence, searching the horizon like a poet bereft of vision too long, or a disciple whose master has left him to his own fire. The fields lie about you, untilled and untamed. They know your name, but you are the sound of your voice, calling out names that have no face, no meaning to them. Blinded by your desire, you cannot hear the beat of the earth that does not cease. It is the rhythm of grown things that live each day in the fullest measure of their joy and grace. In you, so gifted with more thought and feeling, do not understand as much as the green and winged children of the planet. They fell from paradise with you, but it lives within them, never really lost, but hidden from the view of man. If you could see how much more joy is yours in the finding, you, lined with the thoughts of godhood, you with the lineaments of the Creator, His stamp is upon you, but in your loneliness, His gentle breath at your back is nothing but a chill wind.
As an introduction to this short poem, I just wanted to tell you a little bit that being here actually is rather an astounding experience. Shane called me on Wednesday evening. I just got off a plane from South America, which in many ways is almost a land of poetry. It seems like every other person writes poetry in South America, much of it not very good, but much of it astounding quality. And been in the homeland of Pablo Neruda, the great Chilean poet, where the land of drooping pines, a line from one of his poems I remember. But I actually started writing poetry again after years and years and years when I was in Latin America, in Bolivia, during a particularly difficult experience. I had had my passport stolen, all kinds of things were lost, and all kinds of emotional issues. And for quite a while, I'd been struggling with academic writing because it was troubling me deeply. And somewhere, I sort of put everything academic aside and just started picking up books of poetry. And it was an immense, amazing solace to my soul, like you would be hard to believe. Part of my mind was troubled because I wanted to analyze, I wanted to find, the coherent reason for everything. But then there was something in form, in craft, in the beautiful use of language and the nice conjoining of images that was soothing. And suddenly I felt the desire to write, and I tried. And I'm in some ways a little embarrassed to be here because this has been a very personal endeavor. I'll leave it there. It's been a very personal endeavor. Now, right to the point. I was seated in a car in South Salido, California, in Marin County, that I'm sure you know of. It struck me that in Spanish, South Salido means the little willow grove. And there seemed to be such a contrast between that and the immense material mess of South Salido. It's a very sort of trendy, somewhat bohemian community. Sort of bohemianness and the material wealth just clashes. So this poem is entitled Susurro del Sausal, which is the sigh of the willow grove, or the sigh from the willow grove. Life is like a splendid whisper. It comes. But before we truly hear its softly shaded sounds, it leaves.
That is another one. You will see it sunstone. I think poetry is probably personal for all of us. Mm-hmm. It is different to sit and read it, and yet there's that old tradition where poets would be people who would entertain even at dinner. I think that was kept more alive in the East, certainly in the communist world. They did that all the time. They closed into the factories and so on. So yeah, it's a little new for us. Maybe something we should get back. This is a poem of mine that is so outdated now, and I'm delighted that it's outdated because of the reason why, which you'll see when I read this. But this poem was got a fair amount of attention. It was nominated for the Risling Award, which is the highest award possible in science fiction poetry. And anyway, it's called 100 Years of Russian Revolution, 7 November 1917 to 7 November 2017, which of course is a date now that will probably not even be marked. I think that's wonderful. Novaya Moskva, Mars. The sky was red all morning. The world will think we changed it. Tinted lenses, pre-programmed computer length images to mark this day. But dust storms raised from Hellas to Arjaman's gritty air gave this week's sunsets kaleidoscopic sheens and made the dawn skies red. We did no work. Sergei put out chessboards. I would not play. I sat to hear recorded words from home, hear my family speak to me. Winter, snow, cold, anger iced hard enough to drive on, with flowers in the windows and Irkutsk ablaze with celebration. Hearing them talk hurt worse than love, hurt worse than leaving Earth. 10 comrades partied north, computer said, content to hear their letters wait. I pulled on suit, boots, left Novaya Moskva and walked east, wishing them to Lake Baikal. What was
that? This is part of a cycle of Hamlet poems, sort of alternate world Hamlet poems. It's entitled Hamlet in Cairo, where the ghost watches the moon rise over Seti's pyramid. I could stay in the grave, Horatio, but give myself to water more than earth. The Nile shivers with a ghost or two. It's in the blood from father to son that being dead we may be what we like. He ate the body of vengeance. Me? I claim that tree at Seti's grave. More fitting kingdom passed to me, a pond with two swans and a maidenhead. Imagine the maid then as this moon, white of face and, like tender griffins, set among the stars with posies on an arrowhead. I can sit on the bow to watch her rise and catch the shimmering tail of asps nodding over his veiled eyes. Goose, not him. Let dead kings lie. I mean the moon and Seti. See how she pulls herself against his side, one sphere, abreast a womb, an open eye. Athena, then. Or was it Artemis? An archer, I think. No matter, dust is to dust. Delusions will get you, six princes, no more, to bear you up. But say she sings the softest lays, places buttercups on your bones 9 years hence. No mother's kiss could live you better. Watch close, Horatio. She leaves one drop of honey to linger from between her lips. At that point, when he is no more than a shadow held against her, he would almost think he lived again.
I think in a lot of the textbooks I read about poetry in college, it talked about how poetry could be a way of assimilating experience and making sense in the world. And I think no matter how old we get, we're always assimilating things and trying to make sense of the world. And this poem is trying to make sense of death and also incorporating what we believe about the eternity. Departure into new country, Grandpa. The sun draws a gold blanket across Grandpa's face and chest. In late afternoon, points of light band his fingers in their blindness. And so he lingers while the cancer grows. He watches the robins, the orioles, the blue jays eating just outside his window. He sleeps in the noon sun, dreaming of his father, his sisters, and a brother, whom the cancer sent into the new country. Grandpa wakes to find his children sitting in the room, chatting with Grandma about garden zucchini jam and bread. I talk to him about my wedding in early spring. He smiles when I say I'll need a marble rolling pin. I do not tell him what it meant to me when once he said he wanted to live long enough to see my first child. Crossing over. Grandpa has crossed into a gray land of fog and rain. Even the voice of loved ones is cruel, rousing him from sleep back to the daylit valley of pain. He speaks, but the spirit of death muffles each word, making it echo down a stone corridor. Grandma draws the sheets over him, shifts his pillow. She smiles when she talks to the women about raising babies and baking Christmas cookies. But at night, she lies awake, listening to Grandpa breathing. When we pray for him, what can we ask for? How we want to ease his departure, and oh, the words that we want to say. The candle, the token, a lamp that we would light for his crossing. But he must go alone, caught between the voices of those left behind grieving and the voices of those who wait to greet him. The watch. It was an outing for a princess to go fishing with Grandma and Grandpa. Out to the stands of maple and oak, the expanse of blue water. Grandma warned me off the rocky beach. Grandpa would stretch back a long arm and throw out the fishing line, plunging up the sky and into the lake that was deeper than sleep to this little girl. And we would wait, watching the bob until it dipped with a mystery. Grandpa helped me reel it in. He let me run my fingers over the scales of the bluegill, let me dangle my hands in the minnow pail. We never said much, Grandpa and I, but then how much did Christ say to two men when he told them they could become fishers of men? The new country. He laughed on a Sunday morning when Grandma went to another room. He laughed as fast as a candle blowing out, gently as a thin wisp of smoke rising after the small flame goes. The voices called him across the bridge into the new country, and they came to him singing, whispering, or saying nothing but taking his hands and looking into his face. Those of us left behind are praying that when we walk towards that place, Grandpa will call to us across the water, take our hands and reel us gently in.
Image is a very hard one to follow. It's something that's very personal and moving, I think, to all of us, and all I can say is I second it. But to change the mood, I'd like to read something political. I was in a meeting, meeting of ethnic studies, and I was hearing what I would consider liberal balderdash about, liberal to me means what republicanism means to most people. Namely, that it's the same thing. I was hearing liberal balderdash about freedom. It was talking about the ability of an individual to do whatever they want and be whomever they want. And I was just struck by the nonsense of that, given this just burdens of society and how difficult it really is. And this is my response. Freedom, they say, is not a gift, a Christmas orange, apple, or pear. It is something you choose to take, like a rotting bird in a cherry tree. So pick your freedom, they say. Savor it. Enjoy it for yourself alone. Is freedom, though, a cherry? Juicily clinging to its stem while awaiting my touch? Was freedom rather a pear, green and hard in its leafy perch, needing me to ripen? Is freedom perhaps an apple, tart until after an early frost its sweetness beckons me? With basket, ladder, and firm grip, I reach up into the trees for cherries, pears, and apples. I grasp them, twist them, pull them, wash them, wrap them, and box them. Until my muscles ache, I pick the freedom for others to taste, and can only keep spilled juice on my chin.
That's great. It's interesting to me as I sit here and look at these poems. I can see, of course, the poems on the page, and interesting forms are being used. You know, interesting things. I know that we've all probably made up a lot of the forms that we're reading. You know, which is a fun thing to do. So when you see this in sunstone, sometimes. I wanted to read one poem from a series of poems I did about Persephone, the old Persephone myth. And this is one in which I imagine Elizabeth I of England meeting Persephone. Elizabeth, of course, has gone with everyone else into the afterlife, and it's not at all what they expected. It's, in fact, the Greek afterlife. So, this isn't, and this poem will be published in Asimov Science Fiction Magazine. It's called Elizabeth I, On Seeing Persephone Walk Through the Gates of Hell. And she's speaking, let me just say another thing before I start. She's speaking to a man, Robert Dudley, who was the man she loved and whom Parliament would never let her marry. And so that's the reason, of course, she never married. She refused to have a lifelong affair with him until he was killed. And so she's speaking to Robert. She comes again, Robert. There, another half year marked. But for her, we would not stand here in any peace. Have I told you the story? She came to me, Robert, when I was lost among the millions crushing sticks and said, do something for your people. Find a way to help them. And I lifted up my eyes and saw this hill. I need a staff, I said. So she brought me one of Charon's, and I set out to climb through all the clawing thousands that thronged these slopes, thousands babbling at me in the tongues of India and Cathay. And when I reached the top, the winds blew, yet I had nothing to fly from my staff but my red skirts. So I tore off a goodly part, tied that to this staff, and held it up in the wind that blew my hair, and my torn skirts, and my red flag. The multitudes riding along sticks quieted and looked at me, and I shouted, England stands here. And they came to me, my English boys who drowned fighting Spanish fleets, my farmers, my generals, my sturdy village women, even my poets, even Walter came. And we made this hill a little England for the people of all the times of England, an island of safety, a refuge of peace and learning in a sea of unexpected chaos. And we stand here yet, Robert. England yet stands here, and will, till all the English have crossed Styx, and I, the last, will let them greet me on the other side.
Have you ever had one of those jobs that just about threatened to drown you? Sure, just about everybody has. In the middle of the one that I was in, I wrote this poem to somehow get some of the feelings out. It's called Lament Don Quixote in the Modern World. Bah, Pancho. Hold no mirrors here. The purest nights are too damn bright, and science is never truth without some source of tempering beauty. The words are succulent, Pancho, but if pi r squared had an area, still it has no soul. Its speaking leaves me with each dawning day with another piece of that damned pie upon my face. I live by such a feeble grace. If I could, I'd rest above the roots of Spain and sleep away a century, until at last my idle thoughts decayed to rich, momentous histories. I read a book an age ago, some pages and I beneath a tree. A fellow in Maine once slept like this, walked into the woods and was not missed until his time clocks rusted with the rain that did not touch him once upon any time. I joust machines. Even in a dreaming day when the skies are filled with an indigo wind and the windmill's blades clatter uttermost sighs, I must produce. They do not pay for languid thought from minds at play. By need of food I am reduced. To work, to live, to breathe out my deductions, while the best of bread is found in waking dreams. Ah, Dulcinea, can the stars be written into memories that are not made? Any more than whores touch love on the face of money? In dreams they love. The circatory mistress bathes a wan synthetic muse. She stands and waits. Every silent move betrays the arms propelled, the click, click, click of her metal tongue, the basic flesh of a man compelled to crawl inside her. While she suckles me, I sharpen my teeth against her fetal pose, a taste of milk, wrung from air and dreams as it dries to chaff against my lips. It hurts. Dulcinea, dance with me. You see, even a harlot may find in her step one final graceful arabesque. Lift your skirts then, dance. The frenzy of the fatal tarantella will lash our flesh and blood to bruise the serpent's hooded head and raise the dead, and raise the dead.
This poem is called Bombs Over Baghdad. One word has broken the mountain fastness around the city where I live. Tonight, we will not watch the stars come out, but sigh as the light departs, leaving the cold, flat robes of night as the moon rises from the smoking corridors of Baghdad. Only the stars and the moon have a wisdom that comes from their ignorance, that blood has no nationality, that women and children scream in the same language, and men taste fear as a cold metal coin they dare not swallow, like a weight on their tongue, ready for a possible meeting with Sharon. Is this the first dream and the last visions that we shall ever have? Is this the fire whose ashes will give birth to a better age forged from a hard-won wisdom? Even those who find belief too hard are whispering, if there is a Savior, then now is the time that he should come.
All of you are reading poems I would love to accept for Sunstone. We've got to talk afterwards.
Well, we're on the risk again of breaking that, so. not going to work it to not break it. Anyway, I spin. In my works, I spin. Bound and snapped by a dirty cord, I spin. Self-absorbed hands prove through me their selfish worth. From backyard play to money walls, from pedant's chorus to lawyer's turf, from friends' careers to enemies' embrace and manipulated games I spin. Unaware of others' full intent, unadorned by their true concern, simply, silently, servilely I spin. But where is the hand to still my motion? Where are the fingers to calm my twisting? Where is the palm to bring me rest? Where is the love for which I long while I spin?
That would be just a crazy little poem I wrote years ago, and it's kind of fun to do funny things sometimes. I had an author that I particularly admired, C.J. Cherry, and I took each title of her book and made a poem out of all of the titles, and this is what I came up with. It's called Dreamstone. The fires of Azeroth still burn with light from faded suns that voyage into night. The merchant slug waits down below the tree of swords and jewels, brothers of earth. Hunters of worlds fear no serpent's reach, no charmer's cry. All pride ends at sunfall, all fear at Hestia. Waves without a shore that lap the gate of Ifril and fill the well of Shiawan. Hold the dreamstone high that lights eternity's own port, Gehenna's 40,000, Moskva's ancient beauty.
Well, this is a brand new one. And, it's done in a dialect. I'm not sure that I can repeat that dialect. I'm sure when you're reading it, you kind of apply those things yourself. But it's from the point of view of a child in the future. Again, it's another virtual reality poem. It's from the point of view of a very poor child in the future. where a lot of the places in the cities have become terrible dark ghettos to live in. And it's called Crossover Children. Crossover children, they all meet, so we plead all so sweet. TV man, come take them home. Warm, wide place, I want some. Sweet Willie wears his head all day, there he work, there he play. In his head, Willie, he's so bad, but his heart stay behind, so sad. Crossover children, they never cold, don't be hungry, don't be bold. Me on the street, I carry a gun. Crossover children, get all the fun. My brothers, they beat me, feel so bad. Like my old dad. I cry for the sky, but you keep on raining. I cry for the angels, but I keep praying. Crossover children, they calling to me, floating on boats in a pretty white sea. There they be fishing and eat what they catch, and rumble just looking at that. I cry for the children on a bright white sea. Here they come now, looking for me.
I'd like to read a poem called Beyond Byzantium, and I have to preface this with a remark. It's sort of a rebuttal to a poem written by William Butler Yeats, and I don't want to be presumptuous because he's my very favorite poet of all time, and I really enjoyed going to see the places where he lived and worked, but I really disagree with him on one point. So I'm just telling him what my opinion happens to be about certain theological things. Okay. Beyond Byzantium. I will not sail to Byzantium, where I could sing of moments from sensual music I once knew. The splash of salmon, a face lost in my hair, a child's two hands curled in my palm. I will not sing, but wither away like a fading score. The bars fall apart, the shredded cords scatter like gold, scarlet, brown leaves. Perhaps I shall be a leaf floating downstream, or nestled in a dark place, fragmenting beneath the stars into solitary notes. Sense will dissolve into sheer sound. A percussion of light shall root down to my darkness, tendrils snapping neurons into place. The spirit will have no mouth for its creation's song until soil turns to bone and flesh, till hands crawl past worms and maggots, claw up through earth, clutching for the burning spear of light. Sense shall come on a roaring, remembered wind, throwing a gasp between my lips, one note, then my hands clapping, clapping to hear the corded flesh and bone, the sound and words, words to call to my creator with, and a body not of hammered gold, but of flesh as young as a rose, limbs strong as salmon in the stream, outlasting tarnished gold, and figures frozen solid on an urn.
I have a friend from Egypt, and she's actually a rather eminent psychotherapist, psychoanalyst. And it's lovely to talk to her. One thing I love is her ability to express drama as part of everyday existence. She often complains about life in the United States, where people can't keen, where they can't shout their anguish, they can't yell. When we find someone grieving or angry, we kind of stay away as if the emotion were somehow dangerous. I just came back from Latin America, and that's not the case. Anger and yelling and screaming and keening and wailing, all those strong, powerful emotions, not to mention love, are part of life. This is my feeling of being an Anglo-American. Like a cicada shrieking in a tree, I wish I could anger all those around. I would buzz in unfettered dissonance, vibrating, clashing sounds to pierce people's walls of selfish contentment. I would scream in the fall summer's evenings they build like a cocoon to protect themselves from others. My head reels with rushing, crashing, revolting sounds they give to me in their self-centered search for phony summer. Don't tell me your problems. I've got enough of my own. Be happy. Come on, don't be a party pooper. Their summer deafens me with its contrived Baroque harmony. I can only screech like shrill-locked brakes. Listen to me. Hear my song. Instead, they throw their pretended warmth with smiles and charm like nasty stones to dislodge me from my perch, to silence my frustrated, angry sound. If I were a cicada, I would fly to the next tree and shriek off.
All right, well, I'll change the mood now. This is called When the Last Day Ends. This was a poem published in Asimov's last year. When the last day ends, when the last dream fades, when the last lover's kiss and turn away into the night, the last moon dims behind the last snow falling, falling when the last smoke clears, when the last wind stills, when the last eyes blink and stare at nothing, the last bird calls.
Well, now you know I have to resort to my thesis.
Yes, good.
During defending my thesis, Edward Geary remarked that it seemed that my poetry showed a definite bent toward the gods Eros and Priocupos. He asked me why, and I told him, well, I'm single and I'm Mormon and I'm young. What do you say? Some of it's kind of embarrassing to read. This one's called Flash of Fire. In sweat I am awakened by the stretch, the shuddering end of it in the early morning flash of clarity that is blue and sharp like the daybreak rising of an early winter moon. I rise from the sweat of dreams and follow them outside, out where the nip of cold nips my breast until they fill and round them and rounds them pregnant like sharp silver mothers. I stand in white grass bearing goosebumps over an earth that is mine and with witching eyes raise the midnight beauty of the waiting mountain stones.
Well, I was going to read a love poem, but after that I decided to change my mind a little later. It's called The Bells of Boston. Hidden between the skyscrapers, the old church sit like aged women veiled in lace who settle in worn pews next to the tall, slim girls with direct eyes. Theirs is the grace of a tree bent by wind, but still bearing quiet, delicate blossoms. When they speak with their bells, they call us back to a century no less harsh than our own, that in those years grew more arbors of the old belief, where we could walk and bring our joy and grief. I think of the child I was, so eager for Mass, to hear the bells calling us in. I wanted to sit by Grandpa, who was quiet, strong as stone, but who touched me as though I were a flower. When he and Grandma bowed their heads, I wondered what they were saying for what they asked. Now in my hotel room, I hear the bells ringing in a chorus all over the Back Bay of Boston, from Copley Square echoing over Cambridge. They sing, waking an answering voice in my breast, gathering like angels.
I always loved that poem, and that was printed in Sunstone. I was glad we got it.
The night is soft. It surrounds me in its forgetful embrace. Its dusky, silky skin slides slowly over me, stealing away my daytime salt.
Another poem you'll see in Sunstone. Mm-hmm. I think I'll give you a preview of some of the other poems now that I've been accepting for the last few months. I'll read one by Sean Brendan Brown. I just wanted to say, Sean is someone, I've been buying his poetry since I first started doing this in 1990. And he's not here, so I guess I can say all this. You know, when his poems first came in, they were very difficult, and I didn't take any of them. They were pretty good, but he has gotten so good. I think his poetry is wonderful now. And he sent me a group of about 12 poems, and I ended up taking just about all of them in the last bunch. And it's been really fun working with the poets in Sunstone. I have to, you know, just an aside on that. It gets so you really kind of know these people. And when I accept someone's poems, I send them my home address and tell them to send their poetry straight to me, not the Sunstone office. And they end up writing letters and calling me just to talk. And I get letters with newspaper clippings of things they've done back in Minnesota. And, you know, it's really kind of fun. Because I have all these files with all these people. Anyway, Sean is one that we talk once in a while just on the phone. But this is a poem that he just sent me called Why Nothing Beautiful Knows Exactly Why. When we plead guilt for any reason and do so vaguely assuming our lives or feelings will be spared, God will not. The secrets of all other hearts revealed to our verisimilitude as sinners, the truth as defined by the faithless makes you foolish. An alarming noise rises from the cities, the rout of dominant religions and the wagon loads of legal error burned. The people sing ancient songs of ancient judges who proclaimed when life and liberty were self-evident,
It is better that 10 guilty persons should escape than that one innocent should suffer. Duty, were to hold you fast and baffled, eyes wiped through black holes, underfoot the trembling wood, duty, where it told you hold your tongue, waiting for the rope to seize your neck, would you not malign duty for dignity? Still you stand, seized and throttled. In the slums, a college collage of limbs and 2020 illusions, still I go on teaching, the money-making schemes of outside worlds. This mush, this tasteless gruel of business, eats its maker and the great maker God we try reduce to Boolean algebra, to wine, and polite hors d'oeuvre conversations. This is reality to the faithless, war, politics, art, hazards to be passed, love, the breakdown of devoted statistics. Children, weak and grinning spawn, nation's dream of sovereignty felt, heard, seen, shattered. That was a beautiful poem. Go ahead, Jenny.
Called the Night Fire. A bright star might have foretold the moment, might have brightened with the magic of the tendril being made, but on that night, like every night, the far lights burn the same, gold and silver tones along cathedral tiles of an azure blackened by the coming calm. That night was still like every yet and past, and no god would have noticed it, if not for the tingle of our hands creating fire in the silence.
This poem is called Seed of the Second Birth. I wade through the turning days, the coming and receding sunlight through the ivy and lace curtains, onto the ear-drawn grain of the wooden floor, the fine bones knit, the nerves laced together. My blood, once mingled with my mother's, now mingles with the blood of this child, who is a sliver of moon inside me. In pain I will bear this child, and in reflex, in fright, he will cry when he sees the light. But he will come to know yet another darkness, different from the one he knows now. He will not hear my heartbeat, and his hands will not grope through fluid shadows. He will be born again, but he will know the darkness and smile to see the light. In one motion of the wind bending one petal on flower, spirit and bone will knit again. But this child will not cry, for he will know where to stretch his hand and whose name he must call.
Like stone-clad mountain lake, names fall through my life. Some skip and return two, three, four times. Others explosively drop out of sight, leaving wrinkles to age my face. That's good. This is a poem from Laura Hamblin. A lot of us here know Laura. We went to college with her, and it was fun to get some poems from her. This is called Lament for Leah, which is, again, back to the same myth, or not myth, but biblical story that Carl was using. And Lament for Leah. On the night when Jacob took Leah, when he supposed he held his love 7 years earned, as he undid her hair, did Leah's breath stop, her lips holding the secret waiting to be given away? Did she whisper, "My love," as if speaking the words would make him so? And did Jacob wonder at her ordinary thighs, or did he, in his drunkenness, grant them another's beauty? Did Leah dare to embrace her husband in their one essential deed? Or did she simply endure the staining of the bed while the soul of red opened to her? Was the morning stone gray and still when the softness of sleep left Jacob's eyes and he saw with revulsion his tender-eyed wife? Did her pride grow small and her hopes whirled narrow as he cried out against their sacrilege of love? As he cried out for Rachel, did his wife turn to prayer for an open wound, that heart-bound gift? Did she have any vision of the women to come who will never sit near any well's mouth? The elder sisters given in haste, who, with fair eyes or not, will see through the prism of marriage, through the cut glass prism of marriage? It's a powerful point.
Well, this is the one that Shane's taken his titles from, and I think they're better out of context.
I don't think so. This is published in Sunstone, the entire poem.
South Sea of Sinai. Sand, sun tarnished, slipped through tracing Nile fingers, trickling dust, pushing gritted waves in the slow thrust of burial seas, writhing dunes, covering evenings, unwriting runes scrawled in pale sweeps of sand and hide that swept immutability under their slow and rising tides, and left nothing behind but dawn and a new horizon, touched by a wave of wind on an ever-setting sun. All stench sunken, all sight. No trace of evident history. Only the calm remains that was there before, and the silence of slow waves breaking.
Many more titles to be used there.
Just a little background on this poem, The Wind in Boston Harbor. Whenever I'm there, my favorite part of town is where all the Irish pubs are. Before you get a bad picture of me, I like to go for the music. And my husband is from Ireland as well, and we both get homesick for Ireland, each in our own way. The Wind in Boston Harbor. Whipping off the bay in Boston, a cold wind blows us across the cobblestone street. Replicas of wind clippers bob uneasily, nervous as horses chomping at the bit. How could anyone not feel the restless desire in that wind, carrying the breath of Europe, cold and distant as it may seem? Even in the pubs where Guinness warms the belly, Irish voices join in song against the new and clamorous country. The wind barrels down narrow streets, rattles windows. Is this why so many Irish settle near these shores, to hear that wind off the sea? Even I, fresh from mountains that used to bar all restlessness from my life, cannot ignore that wind, thrusting the waves upon the wharf. One day soon, I will go down to the ships, and with one breath of my body, feel their sails and leave.
Well, I'd like to read one about frustrated love. Dividing lines. I stand on the margins and long to be inside the illuminated words, and straightforward chains express the text of your life. I quietly watch as you interconnect your words with those around you, so long as they stand within the lines that keep your text together. Must you always justify the straightness of your blindly held boundaries that in their watchful integrity keep my disorder from coming in? I really want to be within them, but never will they let from behind their tightly turned backs my pale hoping enter. Nor will they permit your text to flow into my open pool. Not even a simple acknowledging word will they allow from their jealous grasp. Please look out for your poem, your prose, your limiting form. I stand near their wall, merely wanting to talk to you.
I'll read another Sean Brendan Brown poem. This is called Strolling from the Deli, Grocery Laden. There's this new generation rising among us without the will to live. Psychologists argue the pattern of life's incapable intellectualizations. Educators argue lack of moral courage. I have walked among the garden idols, seen my leaders tricked into the marriage of admitted deviancy and failed nerve. Still, the plaster statue sellers cry, "What is wrong? What is wrong?" as our youth continue to die daily. There are parties to attend. We blame them, they're dying, as we stroll home arm and arm full, excited over the boiling of lobster, the sweet interior of cracked claws, the spicy artichoke leaves, the musky scent of shanty freshening across the maple walkway.
Well, light the mood. This one's called Death. Cretin, I said, and he laughed, a song of delight that wavered black and gold over my fresh grave. How would you like it, he asked, as though one lump or two would do the job. I came to tea, I said, and he poured me a wine thick and red, then smiled, handed me the cup. Tragedy is so perverse. I thought to spare you, what, a fire, drowning perhaps, a beating by your friends. Some wild animal dining on the bones and blood that made you. You've had no shriek in the night, no tearing at your throat by knives or vicious teeth. My last customer saw a werewolf once. My shiver rippled the red in my cup, but I thought we were
Friends? Of course, he said. But why do you worry? Maggots must also eat, and you have often dined on long dead flesh. And I cleared my throat to say, her invitation was macabre, more than I expected on so bright a day. And he only smiled, held out his hand. I asked his price and did not wince at the cost of crossing sticks, but asked only what manner my death would be. He gave no answer, but only turned in his consummate silence and tipped his roiling crown in rakish gesture on his head. I thought no more to chide him on his manners.
Well, this poem that I'd like to read, I too wrote when I was single and preoccupied and eros were second and third gods to me, but I think that what I wrote here remains true even though now I'm married and supposedly live a dull life. This is called Passion. People think the passion of love is a sea crashing in breakers, tossing frantic shadows across cliff and shore. What can we know of the discourse of silence? Grandma and Grandpa know, washing dishes. Grandma washes the knife and, not looking, hands it to Grandpa, who blindly takes and dries it. Two dancers moving slowly across the quiet stage, with the only music of breath and a void creaking under the touch of toes. The shapes of silence lie between bent arms and legs, curved fingers, fluidly changing line with the sea's edge on the shore. There are deep, pure wells we never draw from. We prefer the dashing breakers, the violent taking, the seawater that cannot slake our thirst.
Bring me a guitar, the song beats within me. Bring me a guitar, a song flows through me, sounding its life-giving rhythm. Bring me a guitar before it's too late. Hurry, bring me a guitar. It pounds on my soul, threatening to break me if I frustrate its birth. Quick, bring me a guitar before the song steals the meter of my life in its still passing. Bring me a guitar. I need a guitar with strings and fertile box to save me from this song.
I think you probably can see it Sunstone. It's on a future date. I love that one. How many of you have seen the current issue, the one that was just mailed at Sunstone? Good. And I'll read one of you. I'll read you guys
today.
Okay. There's a poem in there by Philip White, who also a lot of us know. I went to college with him. And this is one of the most beautiful poems that I've read in a long time. And it's one I think you can hear again and again. It's called A Trip to the Sea. Once more it is burned over the blue sea, over the black-hulled seine boats working far out beyond the tolling buoys, burned higher, over the trim, green-shingled housetops, the indolent white yachts and steeples of Gloucester and Rockport, burned westward over the abandoned quarry, the sea-blackened granite bluffs, and once more, the beautiful young of those houses came down beneath it to the narrow sands where the surf discards its million imperfect welts and cockles, so many chipped coins coughed up out of death's plenty, and there, they gathered in thin shirts and blouses to feel it burn over their bodies and be warmed in the yellow nectar of its light. We came down through shallow-rooted shadbush and leafless greenbrier, still grasping the shriveled black berries of another season, and stood coatless in the chilling wind where the bramble ends and bare rocks tumble down to the sea. Our shadows fell long across the broken slope, grew, as we watched, longer. And suddenly we knew the stones beneath us to be turning us slowly from the sun. I thought of the lovers and the children of that morning, of the fathers far out at sea, and I thought of the stones, knowing millennia of wind would diminish them, and the sea would one day swallow their shadows, but turning, they seemed so solidly rooted in time that we, whose brief images flickered like the memory of a love or a fear across their faces, would never see their changes. At our backs the sun burned, and the gulls crossed it, hung, trembling on the wind, turned, crossed again, their bodies on crooked wings falling and falling into the circle of flames.
This one's entitled Grandmother Clock. I guess I got the image of a clock because of the way a coffin looks. Kind of weird, I know. She sat in the coffin. The long housing laid along her length. I see the hole, her eyes dulled metallic windows painted over, her face set in the rosewood, all cliches stamped into it. Gray casing, porcelain lines upraised, reaching out into the crackle of spindled hands. When she stood, she had a sunken tilt to the legs. I pass by the burial along the line that winds the spiral snapping at the open face. The smell there, a mustard scent along the spine where damp wood sucked past dry boards, swelled beneath the fading stain. I peer into the open timepiece laid out for my inspection and see no telling. Her hands point 10 to 2, but the hours have been chipped away, have gone into the sand of latent hourglasses fleeting on the mantelcase before the face of relentless chimes and an unsettling wind.
I'm going to start letting Jeannie title my poems for me as they're written. This poem is from a moment in the New Testament, and it basically addresses what I think is one of our fundamental problems in the 20th century, and that is that we are more separated from our Creator than we have ever been, and I think that there's a great amount of loneliness that comes from that feeling. This is called Emmaus. Cleopas, it was he who stirred the dying coals to flame. Did his words not burn within you as they always did? And now we know, always will. Shadows of our grief veiling from our sight, but his words glowed in the oncoming night. And we forgot the dark, the wild dogs barking in the sunset. His presence was like the wind he described to Nicodemus. It touches one as though it were a brother. We know where he came from, but oh, Cleopas, where does he wander now? Through fields of evening light, turning rows of grain beyond these brown hills dry of rain? See there in that tree flaming with the evening's last light, a dove cries softly by the road we take.
Kurt did a whole series of poems set in the Bible like this, and I've loved them all. They're beautiful.
This is a short poem, with which unfortunately I have to end for now, but
okay.
This was actually conceived in Cusco, Peru, at a time when there was a lot of guerrilla violence around about. The context is not obvious, that's why I give it to you. Where is there a singing bird when all I hear is silence? Leaves droop from lonely limbs whence brightly colored sounds once came. Where is there a warm-lit bloom when all is languid darkness?
And again, another poem of Sam Sunstein. I'm just going to check our time. I needed to leave us a few minutes for questions. And I think it's about that time, isn't it? Where are we? When do we end? 6:15, so we have 15 minutes. Do any of you have any questions? If you don't, maybe we go ahead.
I was thinking it's fun to hear who you like, whose poetry you like to read, each of you.
I love the romantic poets probably the most. Wordsworth, Keats, Shelley, Byron. I spent so much time with them in school, and so those are people I turn to again and again. But then the modern poets, Ezra Pound, I love reading his poetry and some of the other images. And then it's exciting to me to read poetry that's just being written. I love nothing better in life than to hear a new poem from Jenny or Cara or somebody else, you know, Laura Hamblin, or get something from Philip White or Shauna. It is so fun. I think there's so much great poetry coming out, and it was just exciting to see it happen.
I think Pound's probably my favorite. T.S. Eliot. Funny thing is, I'm hoping that there'll be a renaissance of fun poetry, good poetry. That would be really wonderful to have, especially some of the classical modern stuff with so many different languages in it and the allusions to different imagery. Funny enough, Shane and I worked on a contest for science fiction poetry this one year during the symposium that we put on.
Back before we thought it could be any good.
And we were really very snobbish about it. There, we would only find maybe one or two, you know. We actually found so many that we had to create different categories of it. And so I'm just hoping that people are becoming more aware of poetry and are more willing to write it and see that we can get a whole bunch going.
Do you see that happening? I mean, is there any evidence that that's taking place now?
In my field, there's a lot of evidence. Science fiction poetry just exploded in the last few years. All the magazines seem to carry it now.
And a lot of it is amazingly literary.
And so,
what do you mean when you say science fiction poetry?
Poetry that's set in the future or deals with the concerns that have traditionally been dealt with in science fiction. But most of the poetry, though, also goes on and addresses some aspect of the human condition, like all great poetry. And so, you know, like my poem, Romeo to Juliet in Utah, there's more than just Romeo actually talking to Juliet, is that they're following their play around. You know, there's more going on in this poetry. One example, I think, would be the Mutant Rainforest poems that Bruce Boston and Robert Fraser did, and those are about to be published in a book. And they are so beautiful. Each one is so finely crafted, and it's about a mutant rainforest taking over South America. You know, brought something that the nations there brought about themselves with their pollution. And I should have brought some. You'd have to read it, I guess, to really understand, but the poems, I think, are some of the finest things I've read in poetry. They're just gorgeous. And so there's a lot of work being done, I know, in that field at least, that is probably going to stand for some time to come. So you see it there. I don't know, really, in other places. I haven't really followed. You know, I follow the church magazines, of course, and see what we do there. And I think in LDS poetry, there's quite a bit of fine work coming out.
You see more of it lately?
Oh, not more of it. What I see is a new generation of poets coming into their own. You know, I see Philip White and Laura Hamblin and Cara and Ginny and David, I guess, you know, other poets that haven't been publishing before starting to publish and starting to send me and all of the other editors great poems. And so, yeah, it's kind of exciting to see this new generation come up and start to send their poetry out and get it published. And, yeah, so you'll see that happen. You'll see a lot more from all of these people.
Can I say something? Because of Elbert Peck, I went with a group of people in actually a folklore class from BYU to Cowboy Poetry Festival in Elko. And the funny was the place was just absolutely packed. And from what I understand, it's getting so hard that they're going to have to either find bigger room or find ways to limit attendance. But the thrilling thing was to watch how much people were involved in the poetry. And you might think that a lot of the cowboy poetry is kind of schlocky. It really wasn't. Some of it was, to be sure, you know, very sentimental and so on. But there's a lot of, I think, really good stuff that was set there. Some of it very academic, and others that weren't academic. The one difference was in the style of recitation and reading. The poems were performed, and as a result, people really got into it and really became engaged. And it almost seems that when we read a poem on a page, it's different than hearing. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here, because a poem as a verbal form has to be spoken. It has to be said. And anyway, I was encouraged by that festival because of what I saw there. I also have to say that if you go to South America, it's not uncommon to see people reciting poetry on the streets of various kinds. In St. Louis, where I live, there's a cafe that does nothing but poetry reading. It's a very widely attended Dust Cafe. And so it seems to me that there's really quite a lot going on. I don't know if y'all saw the article in Atlantic Monthly where it actually said that a while back poetry is in better shape than it ever has been, even though academic poets complain more and more about how marginal they are. But there are more poets writing, more poetry books being sold, more people reading poetry than ever before.
I think that's true, and I've heard some people say this will be considered the great century of poetry, actually, the 20th century. Not that we have had more great poets, we've had more poets writing a few great poems, and hundreds of them out there.
Well, I think, you know, going back to the subject of LDS poets writing, I remember, I don't remember quite where it was, but someone asked Leslie Norris, who is the poetry professor at BYU, and he's not LDS, and they asked him to comment as an outsider, you know, why is it that the LDS culture or church or however you want to look at it doesn't have famous or great poets? And he said something I'll never forget. He said that we are far too self-conscious and apologetic for our beliefs and the way we live. And he said, until that's why you don't have and Isaac Singer, who writes very honestly but movingly of the Jewish culture and religion. And like if you read books such as My Name is Asher Leff, where you have a Jewish artist who is very devout, but yet his culture looks at him as a raging liberal and sometimes as a heretic. I think that we just have to stop apologizing for believing and maybe stop apologizing for questioning and just write honestly and forthrightly. I know for a long time I was very afraid to write about my beliefs, but they're very much a part of who and what I am. They're the center. My religion is the center of my life. I mean, it's not. It's the foundation, and I think that we shouldn't be afraid to present it also in a way that is very unsentimental, but honest as well. But I've never forgotten what he said there, and that's why in one poem I wrote about the mother and the father. I didn't come right out and talk about it. It's something that's very sensitive, and I don't plan to do it here. But it was just my way of expressing my need to worship as completely as I want to in either my poetry or in private. But anyway, I think that as the decades roll by, I really think that. That LDS poetry and art and music will mature and will go away from the sentimental. Well, I don't know if a lot of you are familiar with that essay on pornography that D.H. Lawrence wrote, and he really rips into sentimental, into cheap sentimentality as a form of pornography. And I think as we move away from things like that, you'll see less of our art forms trying to tell us or manipulate us in how to feel and believe, but instead we'll see more art forms showing us what we feel and believe as a people and as individuals, and look at our relationship with God on a community level, on a family level, between two spouses, between friends, and between as individuals with God. I know I try to do that in my poetry. It's just one way of me trying to work out my relationships with the world, and that includes the Creator and my family, my church, my friends, my environment around me. And that's all I have to say. I thought it was a new question that somebody started asking.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah, I'm just curious, from any of you that would like to comment, what happens when you decide to write a poem, and what is it that gets you in front of the piece of paper with the pencil in your hand or whatever it is? What's going on inside of you, and what does it feel like?
For me, it's usually another person. Ginny on the phone yesterday, we were talking, and we both ended up going and writing poems, and we've often done that. She and I used to work together, and Carr and I used both of them. We'd sit there at a typesetter late at night, and we're both all of us exhausted, and we're taking a break, say, and I take the dictionary, open it at random, put my finger on the page and say, here, write a poem using this word, you know, or something, and they come back the next day, these gorgeous poems. But I think that's been what's gotten me the most, is just people's influence, just saying, do this, do that, get me going. That really spurs me.
I think for me, the way it happens the most often is I feel like, and I am not going to say that it's the Holy Ghost. I think sometimes it is, but I think often it's what they call the muse, or what Jung calls the collective unconscious, where I suddenly feel very detached from what's going on around me. And I'll either hear a character from a short story talking to me, or I'll hear people, I don't hear voices or see visions, I promise, but I hear people talking in my mind. I'll see a scene. Or what happened most recently was I was in kind of an odd mood, and I was listening to some music or something. No, I was just listening to the wind outside, and suddenly I saw a woman lying on a mat and there was nothing in the room. It was absolutely bare. There was the moon outside. And she was dying. And the wind kind of created a rhythm for the poem. And I almost saw it as a scene from modern dance. It was very bare and very almost anti-poetic in the way her room was just bare of anything. But I was so taken with that image that I had to go to the computer and start typing. And I passed my husband in the hallway, and he kind of looked at me like, yeah, I know what's going on, because I just have to go and be alone. And I don't know where these images or these situations come from, but wherever they come from, I'm very grateful. But the other situation I find myself in is sometimes my poems are a way of expressing things I find very hard to say verbally. I know, I'm glad my husband isn't here, I can say this, but the first 6 weeks of my marriage, I wrote a poem for him about every week, because there were some things that really surprised me about being married, things that were very quiet and very joyous. And I just couldn't go up to him and say it. I had to put them in a poem and show them, to give it to him, and I couldn't be around when he read it. But that was my way of letting him know what I was really feeling. And he really liked that. And I'll do that for other people that I'm close to as well. Say things that I just don't have the nerve to say in person. And that's fine. They like that. They like it that way.
Go ahead and agree with all she said. To me, I do an awful lot of writing of other kinds of things, primarily boring academic stuff. There's a difference. When I get caught on an academic idea and almost get a rush, sometimes I can't sleep at night because things come. And it's like a very burning that I have to sit at the computer and write. And the ideas often tumble out so fast that my fingers can't get them on the screen in time. It's kind of like the poem about the guitar, really. But my experience with writing poetry has been different. There's been the passion, the desire. I've been caught by an image. Something hooks me, like what happens in academics. But the difference is that it hooks me in a non-rational way. And it's almost like a process of discovery, whereby the whole is in my head. And like a sculptor, I have to take the whole of the stone and chip away the parts that shouldn't be there. I didn't believe in the muse until I started being overwhelmed by the muse. And all I can say is that the muse, when the muse comes, is like passion. And this has really deepened my strong belief in the Song of Solomon that Joseph Smith would like. And Skip taught me a religious vision of the Song of Solomon as well. And in some ways, I like what you said about the religious part of it, because this stems very deeply from my spirituality, although it may not be evident, in the sense that I really feel that spirituality is also a kind of thing that takes over us. And I'm not sure that it really is logical, although once you get into it, you do the logical, you work out the form, you do the honing, the crafting. But the immediate creativity is, all I can say, it's a combination of desire, passion, and possession.
Well, I feel silly now that these are such great remarks. Because my poetry usually comes from something silly that's happened in my life, or at least coming from reading the poem, it sounds silly. Like Ophelia, I went to the movie and I thought, boy, she really got a raw deal, you know, from this poem.
Yeah.
Or Katerina Turnham, I put my cat to sleep because she had a disease, and I felt so guilty over doing that that I felt I had to absolve myself somehow by writing a poem to her. But I don't know. I think during the period of my thesis, it was a very strange year, and I think I was involved in sort of dementia during that entire year, so writing poetry was real easy. But since then, I don't know, it's just been little things that will trigger something, and there's no telling when it will happen, and you can't necessarily force it. Sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't.
Thank you, Wade.
Well, thank all of you. You've been a good audience, and we're out of time now, so we'll let you go to the next session. Thanks.